Okay, we're going to take your phone calls this hour. Robert Schock with us. Forgotten Civilization, next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, back to Göbekli Tepe for a moment. You do find that to be a fascinating region.
Oh,
how
absolutely.
Come? Tell me why.
Oh, well, Göbekli Tepe is, of course, incredibly sophisticated. And what it ties in with what I've been talking about for two decades now, that there is absolutely true, what I would call true, genuine civilization, not 3000 to 4000 BC, but going back to about 10,000 BC, much earlier than anyone ever suspected in the status quo. And secondly, we need to learn from them, because I think that they were absolutely devastated by this huge natural catastrophe at the end of the last ice age, which, in my opinion, ties in with solar outbursts. All the evidence indicates that. So it's not just fascinating that they're so old and they were so sophisticated and that they disappeared, but I believe there's real lessons for us to learn. You know, we need to learn from them. If we're going to move forward.
How many more Göbekli Tepes might there be undiscovered someplace?
Oh, boy. I think there could be quite a number. The analogy I use sometimes is when the first dinosaur was found, no one wanted to believe it. This was back in the early 19th century. The first dinosaur was identified. The status quo community, scientific community, thought this was crazy. Now, look, we know that dinosaurs dominated the earth for tens of millions of years. Even near Göbekli Tepe, the city of Urfa, which is where Abraham is said to have been born, at least according to the traditions there, and you can go and see his cave, they found, for instance, when they were doing some reconstruction of a street, they had to do some excavation. They found evidence of people living there 12,000 years ago. So, you know, this is a site that's been inhabited continuously ever since. So who knows what's under the city that still exists to this day in the hills around Göbekli Tepe. There's lots of indication that there are other sites.
Robert,
this is magnificent.
You wrote a book called Voices of the Rocks, A Scientist Looks at Catastrophes in Ancient Civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
How many catastrophes do you think we had on this planet during our human era?
It depends on how you define a catastrophe. I hate to sound that way. The major, major one was at the end of the last ice age. And, you know, if you're looking at the last 20,000 or so years, we've had smaller ones since then. And probably if you go back further, tens of thousands of years, there were other large ones. They seem to cycle on the basis, you know, large ones, I would say, occur every 10 to 12,000 years. We're overdue for that. They seem to be tied in with the sun. And then on a smaller cycle of maybe about 1,000-year periodicity, you get major volcanic eruptions. You get a meteorite hitting,
right,
that type of thing. So it's hard to say, but I'm sort of...
What would you say, Robert,
outlines.
Could be the most destructive? A volcano,
actually,
what?
No, I think for our civilization currently, the most destructive really would be a major solar outburst, major X-class flares and accompanying coronal mass ejections, because that would, as we were talking about earlier in the show, wipe out modern electronics, and we are so dependent upon that.
What about the caldera at Yellowstone?
Oh, well, okay, if that went...
That's a game.
That probably has a periodicity of about 60,000 or so years. No one knows for certain, but if that goes, all bets are off. That would be a super, super volcano, as they call it. And that would cause massive devastation, because it would throw out ash and debris into the air. It would circle the earth. It would cause chilling effects. It would, you know, block out the sun potentially for years and years, so you could not grow food. Yeah, something like that would be absolutely
devastating. Wouldn't the ash be so hot you couldn't breathe?
That's correct. If you were close enough to it, and when I say close enough to it, even thousands of kilometers away, it could have an effect where you couldn't breathe. You would literally die. People may have been to Pompeii, or at least seen bodies that were recovered. They were smothered in ash from Pompeii in 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius. Think about that happening over half the United States, you know, over half the area of the United States, and then around the world, other aspects of a super volcano, you know, debris in the air, the sun blocked out for possibly several years.
Don't even want to think that. Robert.
Now, that would be devastating. But we know these things happen. I'm a geologist, and part of the point of Voices of the Rocks is that these things happen. We have extinction-level events, as they're sometimes called, and they do occur. This is something to be expected from a geological point of view, whether it's a solar outburst, a super volcano, an asteroid hitting. You know, these things occur, and we shouldn't live in this sort of la-la land, I call it sometimes, where we think everything is fine and dandy and nothing out of the ordinary will ever happen. It does.
Let's go to the phones. Dan is in DeWitt, Iowa. Welcome to the program, Daniel.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Dr. Shock, I've been a big fan of yours ever since you predated the Sphinx and the pyramids and rattled the chains of the establishment. I admire your work greatly.
Thank you.
Some years back, I believe you did an expedition to the high Andes where you were shown faces that were supposedly carved into rock by an ancient civilization.
Mark of Washington.
The face of humanity is the one that I can remember that stuck out. At the time, you seemed a little hesitant to form an opinion. I'm wondering, have you been able to do any more research since then and come to some kind of conclusion?
Yeah, no. Well, it's not absolutely definitive, but Markawasi, which, as you said, is in the high Andes, is an incredible site. And as I've been doing more research on ancient cultures, ancient civilizations, I am more confident that there's a high probability that it goes back to a very remote period and has a human aspect to it. What I mean by that is, even if some of these sculptures started out as natural features that sort of suggested to people faces and heads and sculptures, people come and they touch them up, they recarve them and bring out the features. And I'm more and more confident that's what we're seeing at Markawasi, and it fits in with the bigger picture of civilized people, sophisticated cultures at a very early period in time.
Robert, Michael Cremo, do you know him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Michael Cremo, of course, believes humankind might be hundreds of millions of years old. What do you think of that?
I don't. I'm not convinced that we go back hundreds of millions of years. I'm convinced that we go back further than, you know, the status quo has suggested. We go back further in a sense of civilization, sophistication. I'm not convinced at this point of hundreds of millions of years. I'm not convinced that we were contemporaneous with the dinosaurs. Now, I've looked at some of that evidence, but I find it ambivalent at best.
We go now to June in Lumberton, Mississippi. Hello, June. Welcome to the program.
Hello, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Robert. George, you're asking all our questions.
Well, I'll hold back for a few. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Robert, could you confirm that the U.S. Air Force is shutting down the space surveillance system that's tracking the satellites on October 1st? And I'd like you to comment on something. I was watching the comet Eisen Observatory workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And they were discussing when the tail comes around the sun that it's pointed out instead of following it around.
Yes. Yes, because what you have now about the shutting down of the satellites, I can't speak to the specifics, but a lot of them
would go down
because of funding, and they go down. And this is a real issue. Ties in with things we were talking about before, that we're not spending the time and money and effort to really find out what's going on. And make long-term plans. As comets go around the sun, the tail does face away from the sun. You have a solar wind that blows out and it blows it away. And that solar wind is very important for the rest of the solar system.
Robert, as we look toward the future, I think with all of this, and you know, we've talked about the sun acting up and just about everything else that could happen. What about, we haven't talked about the tsunami yet. Do you weigh and factor some of that in?
Sure. Tsunamis are very, very important. But tsunamis, I shouldn't say but, I, in a sense, as a geologist, they're relatively minor, and that is no way to, belittle the effects of a tsunami, and they can have major catastrophic effects for humanity. But what I mean by relatively minor is they tend to be caused by other things. For instance, an undersea earthquake along a fault line, and that causes a tsunami. And many of those things seem to be tied to the larger picture, For instance, there's a lot of evidence, and I talk about this a little bit in Forgotten Civilization, that earthquake activity and solar activity are interrelated, that we are part of one unified system. So you have activity on the sun, you have earthquake activity, this then sets off a tsunami. So a tsunami in some ways is the final result that we see on the surface, and it can be absolutely devastating, but it's part of the bigger picture.
Grace is in New Rochelle, New York, east of the Rockies. Hello, Gracie.
Yes, hi. Thank you, first of all, for a fabulous show. This topic
is very welcome.
So interested when you mentioned, Edgar Casey. My father had a reading from Edgar Casey.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was, it's under lock and key right now, but it basically, my mother was hoping he could find what he wanted in life. And he was interested in trains and transportation, but it ended up going back to Egypt. Is there any way I could pursue more information on this? It's a handwritten by Edgar Casey.
You have a handwritten
reading.
Yeah,
and how would you like to pursue it further?
Just find out.
You have to get a hold of the ARE in Virginia.
Right.
ARE, okay.
Edgar Casey's Enlightenment Research Foundation.
Right, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
ARE, just Google that. A period, R period, E period. In Virginia, comma, Edgar Casey. Call them. They would probably love this.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's what I want. Some of you will love it.
They may have more records that go with that reading, because they have an incredible archive of records. So they may have more information on that particular reading and when it occurred in the context, that type of thing.
I appreciate it. I mean, people do genealogy, but now I'm trying to figure out if this is different.
They're a very nice group there.
But thank you so much about the information about Egypt as well. And that whole, it's just fascinating.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Wouldn't that be fascinating to have an actual reading from Edgar Casey?
It would be. I'd love.
That's historical.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. ARE would, they'd like it. They'd interpret it. They'd do just about everything with it.
Exactly.
We go to next up, William, truck driving in Alabama. William, take it away.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah,
morning.
My question was in regards to excavating underneath the paw of the Sphinx. You said that it probably takes several thousand dollars to excavate it. Well, I was just wondering also for George if there was any possibility that maybe Coast to Coast listeners, Coast to Coast insiders, and maybe the ARE themselves could all team up to build up funds for a sort of excavation.
If we ever get to the point, as Robert said, it doesn't cost that much. That's something I think we'd like to attempt. I think we're going to have to wait, Robert, until things calm down in Egypt.
I think so, yeah. I think we have to wait till things calm down and stabilize politically in Egypt. But once they do, maybe we could set something up like that.
That would be interesting. How often, how many times did you go to Egypt?
I have lost track, honestly.
That many?
Yeah, I've been going back and forth since my first trip was 1990, so that's, 23 years ago. And I've been going back and forth since then, and I've honestly lost track.
You know, my father, my late father, was born in Cairo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was what was our dream to go back. But he got to the point that he just didn't want to go back anymore. I mean,
really,
he just thought it was dangerous, and he just didn't want to go. And, you know, I've had some opportunities to go out there, but every time I was ready, there was some conflict of something. I would love to do a week's worth of shows by the pyramids.
Oh, that would be great. You know, that would absolutely be fantastic.
While the excavation is underway. But
you were reading my mind. I mean, we're thinking the same thing.
It'd be like Geraldo Rivera in Capone's tomb.
Well, we're doing the excavations, and then, you know, wouldn't that be incredible and find out what's in the Hall of Records there?
An old bottle of wine.
Old bottle of wine from the aliens.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know.
You remember the Vimana, the story of the, you know, the flying machines of India?
Yeah, sure.
Again, I wonder if something like that could be in there. The other thing I thought was, what about the tools that they used to make the pyramids? You know, maybe, let's say they use these sound lifting devices or something.
Maybe,
what if they're in there?
Maybe they're in there, or maybe at least there are plans or records of exactly how they did it. Sort of the manual.
How big do you think that that area is again?
It's maybe off the top of my head 5 by 12 meters or so.
So that's 15 by 36 feet.
Yeah. So I mean, good enough size that you could contain
a pretty good size room.
Yeah, you could pack in a lot of things. I mean, if think about Tutankhamun's tomb. That's of course dynastic Egypt, but look at all the stuff they pulled out of that.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Let's go to Ivan in Bozeman, Montana. Ivan, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You are welcome,
sir. I certainly envy you, Robert, being able to travel around all those places.
Thank you.
That's just great. One of the ancient sites that nobody seems to talk about, I've never been able to find out much information, is about the stone balls in Costa Rica. Have you ever run across those?
Oh, yes. I've not studied them personally, but if I could put a little plug in, I was mentioning earlier that I am going to be a speaker on a cruise in January. It's actually being called the Ancient Alien Cruise, and it's going to be on the Liberty of the Seas ships. But the reason I mention it here is because my good friend and colleague, Hugh Newman, is also one of the speakers, and he's actually an expert on the stone balls of Costa Rica, and I'm sure he'll be talking about them when we're there. They're absolutely fascinating. I've spoken with him about them at length. They're definitely man-made. They're not natural. They're inexplicable. I mean, some of them are beautifully carved. They're huge.
How difficult would it be to make an 8-foot ball of anything that would be perfectly spherical, like a basketball?
Yeah, very, very, very.
The machining that it would take to do that, even out of styrofoam, would be difficult.
Yeah, it would be very difficult. And Hugh is not a geologist. I'm a geologist, so we've sort of been talking about this together. He's gotten, he's done some good studies of them, but it's really difficult to explain them. Now, I want to mention there are other spheres, there are other stone balls, other places in the world which are natural, so they do occur naturally in some cases.
Well, that's true. Robert, we're coming back for more final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast show, we're going to talk about an American legend. Who might that be? It'll surprise you, so stick around for that on our next Coast to Coast show. Plus, don't forget Coast Insiders. It's our chat tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Pacific time. Welcome back, Robert Schock with us, and of course, your final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating planet, Robert.
It is. It absolutely is, and full of surprises.
They never seem to stop.
Exactly.
Do you think that there are some elitists, some power brokers, that might have the Ark of the Covenant tucked away and artifacts like that?
I don't know about the Ark of the Covenant particularly, but I suspect there are artifacts tucked away. either in museum vaults or private collections, probably both. I hate to say that, but I suspect it's the case.
All right, back to the calls we go. West, Judy, Littleton, Colorado. Hello, Judy.
Oh, hi, good morning. Thank you so much for this morning. It's wonderful.
Very well.
One quick question. Could there have been other floods over the last 12,000 years of the Sphinx Chamber?
I'm sorry, say that again? Other floods?
Well, go ahead, one more time.
Oh, could there have been other floods? You mentioned that, unfortunately, it could be flood. The chamber could be flooded.
Oh, the chamber under the Sphinx, under the paw of the Sphinx. There could have been potentially, but what is happening now, to the best of my knowledge as a geologist, is that there's a real problem because it's flooding in the sense of rising water tables artificially.
That's sad.
Which we haven't seen in the past, as far as we're aware, that this is a phenomenon, local phenomenon, caused by modern civilization. And if we're talking not just water, but potentially, to put it crudely, sewer water, that type of thing, this could cause real damage. This is actually causing damage to artifacts in Egypt, up and down the Nile Valley.
Mark is truck driving in Michigan. Mark, take it away.
Yes. Good morning, George. Long time listener. I remember listening to Art Bell.
Well, thank you.
I just have a theory that I've never heard anybody else put forth, as far as the building of the pyramids. What about if they used elephants to help move the blocks around instead of people? You know, maybe they used teams of elephants, because there would have been elephants up there, you know, in Egypt at the time, because, you know, I guess it would have been more more temperate at that time. So that was a theory.
My response to that would be, if the pyramids, which I think they are, go back to an earlier period, certainly the Sphinx goes back to an earlier period, that's when it was going to be more temperate, so that seems a more likely possibility if you go back further in time. In classical dynastic times, elephants wouldn't be doing so well. But all the evidence that I've developed is that the Sphinx and probably the pyramids too go back to that earlier period, as you say, the more temperate time. So, interesting idea.
Okay, thanks for being part of the program. So, as a faculty member at Boston University, do they condone your research and your traveling? I would hope they would, Robert.
Well, they tolerate it at this point. They tolerate it. I'm tenured, and they tolerate it. And honestly, I try to do a good job. I try to, be forthright and follow the evidence. And I know that some people in the university and the archaeology department, I'm not their favorite person, but we try to live together at this point. And also, I think it helps that there's more and more evidence supporting what I've been saying all along, you know, about these early civilizations, and that there are things that we didn't know about, that, you know, we can actually learn something.
All right, let's go to Jeff in Norfolk, Nebraska. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, Rob. I have a question. What do you think will be the most important thing that will cause the destruction of mankind? Will it be war, disease, something, or a weather, or what do you think it will be? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
I personally think it's going to be a combination, because they're not unrelated. Usually what you have, or what I think will happen, is there'll probably be some kind of natural disaster. I suspect the most immediate would be a solar event, a solar outburst, but that will cause, as we discussed earlier in the program, mass chaos, mass havoc. When you don't have water, as we were talking about, you don't have fuel, you don't have electricity, you don't have heat. If it's winter, you don't have air conditioning in the summer. People start weakening, then disease can set in. So it's sort of a domino effect. So I don't think, and when there's turmoil, then you have war, you have people fighting. So I think all of those factors sort of combine. But what happens is we get to a tipping point where our society is so overly sophisticated, if I could use that term, and so technologically advanced and so delicate in many ways. If you think about our electronics and our modern society, so delicate that just one little thing can touch off a whole series of negative events and ramifications.
We have Mary in Hollywood, Florida. Mary, you're up on the air with us. Go ahead.
Good morning or great evening, wherever you are. Hi. I was watching a television show last night on ancient times, and they mentioned that there's a special wheel in which five men would walk inside of it. It had pulleys, and it was able to lift up thousands of tons of rock.
That is something that the Romans definitely used. They used these cranes or pulleys where, yeah, people walk sort of like a hamster cage, and they could lift, and that's known that they used those things in Roman times. There was a definite, though, limit to how much they could lift, although they could lift quite a bit. But one of the things that you have to take into account when you're looking at some of these very ancient structures, for instance, with the Sphinx Temple or what's known as the Valley Temple and the pyramids themselves, is that these huge blocks, tens of tons, 50 tons, some cases 70 tons or more, they were also put into very narrow confines, very tight tolerances, and to build some of those cranes, some of those pulley-type structures, where would you have that located relative to the blocks that are being put together so tightly, so closely? So even hypothesizing they were using something like that in much more ancient times, which we don't have a record of, that really goes back to Greek and Roman times, it's difficult to even figure out where they would have put this machinery, if you would.
We have not had an opportunity yet to talk about Stonehenge, Robert.
Oh, Stonehenge is fascinating. I was actually there in May taking a look at it.
What do you think it is?
Boy, you know, it certainly has, as many of these sites do, astronomical orientations and some astronomical alignments, and that's not unexpected in my mind for two reasons. One, the skies were very important, be it solar outbursts, be it seasonal changes, that type of thing. So from an astronomical perspective, but also astrologically, astrology really was the science of the ancients. So they were very interested in tracking the exact movements of the planets, of the stars, that type of thing. So that's certainly one aspect. And I think when we look at something like Stonehenge, we have to remember that there's a lot missing. This did not exist in isolation, what we now see as a bunch of big stones, Stonehenge. There were other infrastructure, if you would, that went with it, and also, if I could call it mental structure, you know, a whole group of people that we just don't understand that were associated with it.
Between the structures in Stonehenge and Easter Island, which ones do you think might be the strangest?
Oh, actually, I think Easter Island is even stranger. What's going on there? We really don't understand exactly what's going on there with the huge moai.
Is that how they say they walk them into place? Remember?
Yeah, they talk about walking them in place, and that was something that made the news once again within the last year or two. But then there's been other studies which are less well publicized, showing that the terrain that you would have to walk them over in Easter Island, it's a very rough terrain. It's a volcanic island, and it would be almost impossible to walk them the way people are suggesting across the island. So I don't think the mystery's been solved yet.
Denver we go. Hello, Paul. Take it away.
Hey, George and Robert. As always, it's an honor to talk to you. Talking about EMPs, I read the book by William Forshing, One Second After.
Yes, great book.
If that doesn't open some eyes as to how quickly we would fall back into uncivilized times if something like that would happen. You know, it just opened my eyes so greatly to, you know, what you need to prepare for. You know, people had no clue, you know, without their Google, you know. Sure, with Google, everybody can figure out anything. But without some practical real-world skills, you know, there's so many people that are just going to perish away to nothing because they don't have any idea as to how to operate without technology.
No, that's absolutely true. Electromagnetic pulse could, which could come from a solar outburst, or it could come from, of course, a nuclear bomb, that type of thing. I mean,
detonated up there in the atmosphere.
Exactly. It would just be absolutely devastating to our society. And I think you reinforce the point that most modern people, they have no clue how to survive outside of the life they know, which includes, you know, a lot of electronics, a lot of support systems, a lot of community aspects that they're part of.
Well, that's a good point. Let's go. We've got a few more minutes left. We'll take some more calls. Mesquite, Nevada. Hello, Rosemary. It's your turn on Coast to Coast.
Hi, nice to speak to you. You asked about readings of Edgar Cayce, some of the readings of Edgar Cayce.
Yeah.
And a few weeks ago, I was in a thrift shop, and I've got this book right in my hand, the Edgar Cayce Handbook for Health Through Drugless Therapies, and he's got a lot of his cases and the readings on the cases and exactly what he did.
Oh, yeah, I think...
And it says forward by Hugh Lynn Cayce, and it's Harold Riley and Ruth Hagee Broad. And I think it comes through that center by where the Navy SEALs headquarters are in Virginia there.
Yeah, Virginia Beach. And
Virginia
I want to reinforce
Beach.
That you're absolutely right. Edgar Cayce was a real, I'll say, genius and, you know, really gifted at diagnosing people's illnesses and prescribing for them what would cure them, that type of thing, using natural means. I mean, he was absolutely, he had insight how he received it. He had insight.
He may have been
incomprehensible.
He may have been one of the best.
Yes.
One of the best. Okay, we go to Chuck in Bay City, Michigan. Chuck, good morning.
George, yes, I'd like to ask the guest, what's the Sphinx looking at?
What's it looking at?
Well, the Sphinx is looking absolutely due east. It's oriented absolutely due east. And so it looks at the equinoxes on the, you know, the spring equinox, the vernal equinox, and the autumnal equinox. So that's the sun rising absolutely in front of it on those dates. And, of course, this ties in, one might immediately think in terms of precessional ages, because where the sun is in the zodiac signs on the equinox determines in the Western system the precessional age. So we're now in the age of Pisces going into the age of Aquarius. And based on my redating of the Sphinx, the Sphinx was looking at Leo back in the age of Leo, which may represent itself. So the Sphinx, I want to mention about the Sphinx, the head is not the original head. I determined that the head is recarved. It's now a human head. I suspect that originally the
Sphinx was a lion.
Maybe it had been a lion, and it was actually looking at itself in the sky, say 9,000, 8,000, 10,000 BC in that period. And furthermore, when you look at the lion in the sky, Leo rising up, first its head comes up and then its body and its tail surf still sits on the horizon. That is how the Sphinx was originally oriented. The tail was actually melded into the bedrock in the original incarnation, if you would, of the Sphinx. It arose out of the earth just like Leo arises above the horizon.
Let me ask you this. Was it Napoleon's group that chipped away at it?
No, I don't believe so. The myth or the legend is that Napoleon's soldiers shot at the Sphinx. It's probably more likely, I've looked into this, more likely that Arabs pre-Napoleon time were using the Sphinx's head for target practice, cannon target practice. Napoleon was very interested in Egypt and Egyptology in the ancient artifacts, and I'm sure he would have gotten very upset if his soldiers had started doing that.
We've got Roy in Columbus. Hey, Roy, let's squeeze you in.
Wonderful. It's so wonderful to speak to both of you.
Thank you.
Robert, you part of my question you actually brought up earlier in your conversation when you talked about Abraham.
Oh, yeah.
And there's three parts to this, to my question. In Genesis, there was two trees. One was the tree of knowledge. One was the tree of life.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book of Quran, it mentions something about Abraham taking his son and taking this crystal, which is the tree of knowledge, and took it down into the foot of the Sphinx and buried it there. Do you know anything about this?
Down to the Sphinx?
Into the left foot, paw of the Sphinx, into the what you call the library.
Only got a minute left, Rob.
Oh, wow. No, I don't know. I mean, that could be part of the Hall of Records, then. It could be part of what's buried there.
So you think Zahi Hawass has a shot to get back there?
I think he does have a shot, but, you know, it's such a volatile situation in Egypt. There's just no predicting at this point.
No, there isn't, but it sure would be good if he did go back. And, you know, I don't see eye to eye with him on how the pyramids were made. You know, you tell him anything other than Egyptians,
right,
he goes nuts.
Right. But, you know, I'm hoping that maybe with a new regime, with a change, he may actually have a change in heart and be more open to things if he gets back into power.
Well, that's true, too. Robert, thanks again for being on the program. You take care of yourself, all right?
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Robert Schock, and he is one shocking person because he has some great information, and maybe one day we'll get down to the base of the Sphinx and find out what might be in there. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.